From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. Welcome to our daily collection of popular VOA podcasts. Coming up, slow recovery aid in Nepal is putting increasing pressure on its government, as we hear in Daybreak Asia. Nepal's government response to the earthquake is further considered on Asian political scene with Michael Lippin. Sarah Williams turns China focus in the direction of new trade talks between China and Pakistan. Trash. We deal with it, literally tons of it, on land and in the American cafe. Ira Melman says we have tons more in the ocean. David Byrd uses today's edition of Now to introduce us to a new film based on an old novel. Rick Pantaleo helps start our week with another fascinating Science World Express. All coming up today on VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asian news and events for Monday, May 4th. Hi and welcome, I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, the weak government of quake-stricken Nepal, with a reputation for corruption and inefficiency, is facing blame for hindering the massive relief effort currently underway. VOA correspondent Steve Herman is in Kathmandu to explain why.
Various organizations rushing to help survivors like these are complaining of bottlenecks at customs and aid convoys being delayed and intercepted. The magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck at a time Nepal is still recovering from a decade-long civil war and continues to be hobbled by a fractured political system. According to newspaper publisher editor Kunda Dixit,
extortion, blockages of roads, corruption was the order of the day for the last, at least 8 years after the conflict ended, and I would say even during the conflict.
The status quo angers Nepalese trying to help out, such as prominent actor Shiva Shrestha.
If the Nepal government had any brains, what they would do is call together all the outsiders who've come to help and the local NGOs and delegate to them. If the government tries to do it on its own, it's going to be too late.
At Tribhuvan International Airport, relief flights are arriving and materials pile up due to a customs backlog. UN officials want the logjam broken.
You know what government has done now?
Nepal's civil society needs to take matters into its own hands, according to the founder of the Maiti Nepal NGO, Anuradha Koirala.
We don't trust that if we hand over to the government, it will reach to the people who are suffering.
Malvika Suba, lead volunteer for Nepal's share, says the country's government faces a huge test.
When they are levying rules and regulations to us, NGOs, and to all the organizations to be transparent about things, they themselves need to be transparent and accountable.
The international community has pledged an emergency aid more than $60 million. The United Nations says an additional $350 million is needed, with several million people in need of emergency food aid. In all, the total bill for Nepal's reconstruction is expected to total $5 billion.
There's going to be graft. This is an extremely corrupt country. The corruption was really becoming an epidemic here, even before this crisis.
Nepalese must now put their faith in civil society and the media to ensure much-needed accountability as those dollars begin to permeate Nepal's soil, which has already literally undergone a tectonic shift. Steve Herman, VOA News, Kathmandu.
Check out Steve's report at voanews.com. It has some great video from Nepal. Pakistan has urged Afghanistan's Taliban to cease its annual spring offensive and engage in peace talks with the Kabul government. IS Gould joins us from Islamabad on the statement to VOA by a top Pakistani official, which comes as Afghan and Taliban officials together with other stakeholders are engaged in Qatar in an unofficial dialogue about how to end the war.
The meeting in the Gulf state is happening amid a rise in Taliban attacks in Afghanistan as part of the insurgents' annual so-called spring offensive. Afghan officials say days of deadly clashes between government forces and the Taliban have displaced thousands of civilians in the northern Kunduz province. Representatives of the Taliban-led warring factions, government peace negotiators and Afghan peace activists are among the delegates attending the two-day open discussions in Qatar's capital, Doha. Neighboring Pakistan is also reportedly represented in the meeting, but officials in Islamabad refuse to confirm it, though they say they are anxiously awaiting the outcome of the talks. Pakistan has been accused of secretly providing support for the Taliban's past spring offensives. Key fugitive Taliban commanders and fighters have also been allegedly using Pakistani soil for directing the insurgency in Afghanistan. But for the first time, Pakistan last week denounced the spike in violence, throwing Pakistan's complete support behind Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's efforts to peacefully end the Afghan conflict. A Taliban spokesman told VOA its 8-member delegation decided to attend the Qatar discussions after it was agreed that they would not be considered peace talks with Kabul. The Taliban wants withdrawal of all foreign forces from Afghanistan before ceasing hostilities and engaging in peace talks. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The UN Human Rights Office calls the trial of former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, vastly unfair. A UN delegation has just returned from a mission to the Maldives, and it finds the conviction of the former president to be arbitrary and disproportionate to the alleged crime. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In March, a 3-judge panel found former Maldivian President Mohamed Nasheed guilty of ordering the arrest of a chief judge in January 2012 and sentenced him to 13 years in prison. Chief of the UN Human Rights Rule of Law Branch, Mona Rishmawi, headed the mission to the Maldives. She says Mr. Nasheed's trial appears to have been politically biased, inadequate, and subject to external influence.
One thing that was extremely striking there was his inability to submit any defense of any form. So basically, from our point of view, he was totally presumed guilty. The trial was rushed extremely quickly in 3 weeks, all night sessions. A lot of the sessions were without his lawyers.
Rishmawi says the judges refused to allow Mr. Nasheed's lawyers to defend their client, saying they were convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he had committed the offense with which he was charged. In February, Mr. Nasheed was cleared of ordering the arrest of the chief judge, charges that carried a maximum penalty of 3 years imprisonment. But a few days later, the prosecutor general upped the ante. He had Mr. Nasheed recharged and arrested under the country's anti-terrorism laws, which carry a sentence of up to 15 years in prison. Rishmawi tells VOA the judges have incredible discretionary power, so they can do whatever they want.
The main issue for us is the principle of fair trial. If somebody is presented before a court, especially a high-level official like that, the fair trial is the most important issue. And what we saw is that the rules has been really changed to accommodate a certain result, to lead to a certain result.
She says the delegation told the government it is responsible for Mr. Nasheed's safety and that the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights will be watching. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. These stories and many more from Asia are at our website at voanews.com. So is our podcast, Daybreak Asia. Subscribe to it if you like.
Every day at voanews.com, we post a lot of great stories, and we have a lot of chances to read what you have written, your comments on these stories, and we have some of them for you right now. Memories are fresh for the man who fled Vietnam 40 years ago, a personal account by one of our own, Hai Do, who writes, "All I could see were the thousands of hollow eyes looking in despair as the cargo vessel pulled away from its berth along the Saigon River. This moment, so calm and so quiet, was punctured nightly when I woke up breaking out in a sweat after seeing that those hollow eyes were my own. For years after the fall of Saigon on April 30, 1975, the scene played out every night in my sleep as a reminder of how close I had come to being left behind as communist forces entered the city. Doi Dang, who is now from the United States, writes, "My family and I were on the same ship departing from Saigon on the evening of April 29th. I don't remember when we arrived in Subic Bay, but it is a journey I will always remember. A lesson learned from this is the resiliency of the Vietnamese people. Out of despair and chaos, they survived and built a more prosperous and hopeful and peaceful future." Another story on our website, the Syrian government suffering several significant military setbacks in recent days, and for the first time in more than 4 years, forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad are decidedly weakened, according to analysts. Mark writes to us, he says this struggle in Syria is not likely to go away anytime soon. It will drag on for many more years to come, regardless of what foreign intervention may occur. Whatever your opinion on our stories, you can write to us at voanews.com. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. We're glad to have you with us today. You know, in addition to voanews.com, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook, especially one of our favorite places, VOA Asia on Facebook. Stop by, read all the posts that we've put on, lots of stories, and plenty of things you won't find on our website.
I'm Michael Lippin with your weekly look at the Asian political scene. Nepal's government is facing growing criticism from local and international aid workers about its slow response to last month's earthquake that devastated parts of the country. Nepalese customs officials have been slow to process aid arriving at Kathmandu's airport, resulting in frustrating delays for organizations trying to deliver the supplies to the people who need them. Relief workers also have complained about the length of time it takes to secure approvals from multiple government departments to release those aid shipments. James Moriarty is a former U.S. ambassador to Nepal who served there from 2004 to 2007. I spoke via Skype to Moriarty, who's now based in Hawaii, and asked him how vulnerable the Nepalese government is to all the criticism.
Well, you know, the government is a funny critter right now. Basically, it's headed by a prime minister whose party controls the most seats in this constituent assembly, which is supposedly writing a constitution. It has an alliance, the second largest party in that body. So between them, they're fairly comfortable. But if public criticism grows, then you could see more parliamentary maneuvering going forward. Actually, though, the key thing is, will the tragedy actually force the Constituent Assembly to get down to the hard work of writing a constitution? They haven't been able to in a total of 7 years, so it's about time they actually got down to that serious work.
What makes you think that the scale of this tragedy could actually expedite that process of finalizing the constitution?
Because I think you're going to hear a lot of discontent from the countryside, no matter how well the relief efforts go. The fact remains that you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, living far off major routes, and it's going to be tough to get them relief. They're going to be dissatisfied. Inevitably, they're going to be saying, why do we just keep on electing these legislators who go down to Kathmandu but don't finish the task of writing the constitution?
Those lawmakers include opposition Maoists who have been in power several times since Nepal abolished its monarchy in 2008. But the Maoists don't have a good record in government either, according to a U.S.-based development group, the Asia Foundation. I asked the group's Nepal representative, George Varughese, for his view of the opposition's response to the quake.
Finally, the opposition alliance led by the Maoist party has finally woken up to the fact that they could actually try to use this as political fodder. And they've decided to sort of question the government and sort of go to the public and show that they are more active. But, you know, they have no credibility left, so I don't see how that will work. As I say, this is a pattern. And yes, this particular event has cost more lives than any other in recent history, and I dare say that it may even exceed the number of lives lost during the Maoist insurgency, which was about 13,000. And so, you know, I don't think that our current political leaders, at least of this and the next generation, understand any longer what it means to govern a nation from that point of view, the lessons of such events, I fear, will not translate into any particular constitutional content. After all, the constitutional debate so far, at least until last year, was less about principles and more about divvying up the sort of the riches or the benefits of what might be a federal Nepal. Even until recently, until 2 weeks ago, they were discussing which provinces would be carved out of which favorite constituencies of particular political parties. In other words, discussions around the constitution were more about who would get what rather than what constitutional principles must be adhered to.
That was George Varughese of the Asia Foundation. Next week, we'll hear what Varughese and former U.S. Ambassador Moriarty think about the roles of India and China in providing earthquake relief to Nepal, their much smaller neighbor. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Chinese President Xi Jinping traveled to Pakistan recently to launch a major investment program to boost the South Asian country's infrastructure and energy needs. The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC, involves a network of rails, roads, and pipelines through Pakistan to facilitate the transport of oil from the Arabian Sea and Indian Ocean to China. The two countries will cooperate in gas, coal, and solar energy projects to provide more than 16,000 megawatts of electricity, about double Pakistan's current capacity. The state-run China Daily Global Times said in a recent editorial that Beijing views the relationship as one between equal partners, referring to Pakistan as China's iron brother. It said over the next 15 years, the $46 billion Chinese investment will include the construction of roads, railways, pipelines, fiber optic cables, power facilities, and economic development zones. China analyst Carrie Brown of the University of Sydney tells VOA's Victor Beatty this project is part of China's economic initiative of greater cooperation called One Belt and One Road.
Pakistan and China have been very close allies, at least rhetorically, for a long time. And it's really, I suppose, a moment under Xi Jinping when, you know, with his new sort of worldview, this idea of, you know, the new Silk Road, basically the one road, one belt, it's a time of seeing where Pakistan fits into that. There are all sorts of security issues that Pakistan and China do have in common, but also have issues over. And there's also a sense in many ways that Pakistan has not actually got as much economic benefit from this relationship as it could have. So I think this is really a moment when they can recharge this relationship and see where it slots into all of the other things that China is doing in the region, rather than, you know, just assuming that they have a great relationship and not really doing anything about it.
This is a major investment package, $46 billion. It dwarfs the U.S. aid package going to Pakistan. Is China kind of filling a vacuum now that the U.S. has pulled back from Afghanistan?
I think it's very vulnerable. It doesn't share a huge border with Pakistan, but it's strategically a very important one. And obviously, even with the issue of, America now withdrawing from Afghanistan, the kinds of security issues that poses for China, particularly in the Xinjiang region, where it does feel that it has enormous security issues, you know, this means that Pakistan is strategically very important for China. It's a country that it has always enjoyed good diplomatic relations with, but it doesn't really have a strong kind of cultural dialogue with the country. And so there's all sorts of possibilities for misunderstanding. And the bottom line basically is China shares a border and also shares strategic space with Pakistan in ways which are much more immediate and pressing than America. America is remote. Pakistan is right next to China. So it feels it needs to have a stronger voice there and a stronger reason for being there. And economic links, of course, and aid packages are very, very tangible ways of promoting this link.
How would you equate relations between those two countries with China's relationship with India?
Yes, I mean, the issue really is that with India, China still has an unresolved border issue, well, two unresolved border issues. And so it's always got a very complicated relationship, particularly now that India is economically much more important. There's competition between the two. And Pakistan sort of sits between them. It's got a very complex relationship with India, of course. It's historically been a complicated relationship, and it doesn't look like even in the era in which both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers that that's going to get any less complicated. In a sense, the danger for China is that it could be played by Pakistan against India, less likely that India would play it against Pakistan, and so it needs to really defend its interests with Pakistan, its security interests, its trade interests, its strategic interests, but not get drawn into the very, very complicated, India-Pakistan issues where, you know, it may be forced to take sides. It just definitely doesn't want that.
Kerry Brown of the University of Sydney. In tomorrow's China Focus, we'll have more on the China-Pakistan relationship. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. Central bankers and finance ministers from China, Japan, and South Korea said Sunday they remained committed to policies to support demand in the face of moderate and uneven global growth. The policymakers for the three North Asian economies held a trilateral meeting chaired by Japan's Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Taro Aso. That on the sidelines of an Asian Development Bank meeting in Azerbaijan. Their joint statement noted that global economy was passing through an uncertain phase and growth remained moderate and was following divergent paths. The statement also urged a caution in monetary policy. A Chinese regulator investigated Siemens AG last year over whether the German group's healthcare unit and its dealers bribed hospitals to buy expensive disposable products used in some of its medical devices. That, according to three people with knowledge of the probe. The investigation, which has not previously been reported, follows a wide-reaching probe into the pharmaceutical industry in China that last year saw GlaxoSmithKline fined nearly $500 million for bribing officials to push its medicine sales. China's State Administration for Industry and Commerce accused Siemens and its dealers of having violated competition law by donating medical devices in return for agreements to exclusively buy the chemical reagents needed to run machines from Siemens. The U.S. auto industry sales in April came in below expectations as Asia's major car makers' results were disappointing, offsetting strong gains for trucks and SUVs made by General Motors and Ford. Sales reported on Friday by Japan's Nissan, Toyota, and Honda as well combined results from South Korea's Hyundai and its Kia affiliate all missed expectations. That's Asia Business News. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. One of our favorite segments that we like to run about this time each and every day is Today in History, and we're going to give you some actual Today in History features. One from Italy, a skeptical Italian man said he was speechless when he discovered the apparent prank caller he had hung up on twice actually was Pope Francis. Franco Rabuffi said that he was less than amused Monday when someone called his house twice, claiming to be the pontiff. So, of course, he hung up on the caller both times. However, a third call came in, and it became clear to Rabuffi that he was actually speaking to Pope Francis, who is known to make phone calls to fans who write to him. Francis called Rabuffi to offer his well wishes after finding out that the man had been ill. I was speechless, but Francis came to my rescue, saying that what had happened was funny, Rabuffi told a local newspaper. He and his wife attended the Vatican's general audience on Wednesday to apologize in person for hanging up on the telephone to the Pope. Well, you may have heard there was some happy news Saturday morning in Britain, England, London, specifically, after the Duchess of Cambridge, the British royal, also known as Catherine, gave birth to her second child. The little girl came into the world Saturday at London's St. Mary's Hospital, according to Kensington Palace. She weighed 8 pounds, 3 ounces. Her Royal Highness and child are both doing well, the palace tweeted. Well, they grow up, and sometimes they become a little tough to handle, at least for a Georgia mother who had her misbehaving 10-year-old son arrested by police and then posted pictures of him in handcuffs online, which, of course, quickly went viral. Well, it was a kind of make-believe police arrest to scare the young child, and it worked. And, well, we'll see if she has any more troubles with him. International Business News is coming up next with Michael Lippin.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. In today's show, authorities in the U.S. city of Baltimore start to ease security measures after riots broke out last week. Four more survivors are rescued from the rubble of Nepal's earthquake, and the top U.S. diplomat begins a visit to Kenya with counterterrorism cooperation high on the agenda. I'm Michael Lippin. The mayor of the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore has ended a citywide overnight curfew as protesters hold another rally against violent police tactics outside City Hall. Baltimore was in turmoil last week after a funeral for Freddie Gray, a local African-American man who died last month after being detained by police on a street. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake said she did not want the curfew in Baltimore to remain in place any longer than necessary. The curfew had been in effect since last Tuesday. It drew criticism from the American Civil Liberties Union and from business owners, especially local restaurants. The governor of the state of Maryland, which includes Baltimore, said some of the more than 4,000 soldiers and police brought in from other states have begun to leave the city. Governor Larry Hogan said the state of emergency in Baltimore will not be lifted until all the soldiers have left. Rescuers in Nepal have pulled four more people from the rubble of the April 25th earthquake that killed at least 7,000 people. Nepalese police said one of those rescued Sunday is a 101-year-old man who was found about 80 kilometers northwest of the capital, Kathmandu. Rescue workers earlier reported three other survivors were pulled from debris in a district northeast of the capital. Thousands of people remain missing in Nepal, including about 1,000 visiting Europeans. Aid has been slow to reach some of those most in need, including villagers in Powathok, about 50 kilometers east of Kathmandu. One villager there said, "Nobody has come here. Nobody has helped us. We are doing it all ourselves. We are eating whatever little we have." A Saudi-led coalition has landed several dozen special forces in the Yemeni capital Aden as part of its campaign against Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels. Sunday's ground deployment is the first for the Saudi-led coalition inside Yemen since it began airstrikes on the Iran-backed Houthis in March. The coalition denied that a major Yemen ground offensive is underway, but it said the special forces did engage the Houthis at Aden's international airport. Witnesses said the coalition forces were wearing black military-style clothing and were armed with sophisticated weaponry. U.S. senators are expected to vote this week on a bill that would give Congress a say in any Iran nuclear deal backed by the Obama administration and other world powers. As VOA's Michael Bowman reports, the bill has bipartisan support, but any amendments that are made to it could prompt a presidential veto.
If enacted, the bill would freeze U.S. sanctions relief on Iran for 30 days while Congress reviews a final nuclear pact with Tehran. It has the strong backing of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
These sanctions are a big reason why America was able to even bring Iran to the table in the first place. We shouldn't be giving up that leverage now without the American people, through the members of Congress they elect, having a chance to weigh in. Quite simple.
But some of the very Republicans he leads are putting McConnell in a tough position, doing everything in their power to force votes on amendments on side issues to the nuclear talks, like compelling Tehran to recognize Israel's right to exist. Senator Tom Cotton is unapologetic in pressing for so-called poison pill amendments that could derail the bill.
We need to vote. If you don't want to vote, you shouldn't have come to the Senate. If you're in the Senate and you don't want to vote, you should leave. We are talking about a nuclear-armed Iran, the most dangerous threat to our national security.
President Barack Obama says the chance to verifiably limit Iran's nuclear ambitions must not be squandered by airing America's many grievances with Tehran. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
European authorities say they have rescued at least 4,800 migrants in the Mediterranean since Saturday. They said people smugglers in North Africa took advantage of calm seas to put the migrants on the often dangerous voyage to Europe's southern shores. All of those rescued were ferried to Italian ports, with some arriving on Italy's southernmost island of Lampedusa, while others were taken to Sicily and Calabria. Authorities also said 10 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean near the coast of Libya in the past 2 days. Italy says the mild weather and calm seas are expected to boost the number of migrant arrivals to 200,000 this year, 30,000 more than in 2014. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Kenya, where he will hold talks with Kenyan officials on issues such as security and economic development. During his trip, Kerry will visit a Nairobi monument for the 1998 U.S. Embassy bomb attack that killed more than 200 people in the Kenyan capital. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
The 1998 attacks at the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, were a wake-up call for the United States, says Peter Pham, the director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He says the attacks prompted the U.S. government to take a closer look at its engagement in East Africa.
They came less than 2 years after a Department of Defense document on U.S. strategy in sub-Saharan Africa declared, amazingly, for those of us who know, love, and work on Africa, that in the eyes of the planners who wrote that document, that Africa had, and I quote, little strategic interest for the United States.
Counterterrorism and economic cooperation will be two key focal points for Kerry as he meets with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and other high-level officials in Nairobi and when he travels to Djibouti later in the week. His visit comes just weeks after an Al-Shabaab rampage at Kenya's Garissa University left 147 people dead. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerian authorities are providing assistance to hundreds of women and children rescued from a forest in the country's northeast where they had been held by Boko Haram Islamist militants. The Nigerian government said the group of 275 women and children were taken to the Malkoho camp in Yola province to receive medical care, food, and trauma counseling. A camp official said many of the children were being treated for malnourishment, while 21 of them were receiving care for gunshot wounds and fractured limbs. Boko Haram has used many of its female captives as sex slaves and human shields. Well, that's a roundup of the latest world news on International Edition. Join us again at 0330 Universal Time for an expanded look at the latest world news. I'm Michael Lippin. If you'd like to reach me on Twitter, you can find me at Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. Bye for now.
I'm Jim Stevenson with business news from the Voice of America. Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated shareholders on Saturday celebrated Warren Buffett's 50th anniversary running the conglomerate as the billionaire expressed optimism the company would thrive over the long haul, even after he's gone. Buffett and his second-in-command, Charlie Munger, fielded 5 hours of questions from shareholders, analysts, and journalists at Berkshire's annual meeting, including some that criticized the business practices of the firms that Berkshire owns or works with, such as Brazil's 3G Capital. Still, the meeting had a more festive air this year, with more than 40,000 people attending the main event of what Buffett calls Woodstock for Capitalists. Berkshire holds more than 80 companies and owns more than $115 billion worth of stocks. Buffett gave no hints about who would succeed him. He also alluded in one answer to his writing another of his popular letters to shareholders next February, suggesting no intention to leave soon. Canada's Bombardier Incorporated and Egypt's Orascom Construction and Arab contractors will be building a $1.5 billion monorail near Cairo. That, according to Egypt's housing minister, the 52-kilometer-long project is set to be completed by mid-2018 with funding from a 14-year loan. The train will be connecting the Cairo metro system, which is being expanded to areas west of the capital. Cairo, of course, is a centuries-old metropolis where more than 20 million people reside. It has suffered for years from crumbling infrastructure and neglect. Improved public transport could help reduce congestion in streets where commuters compete with commercial traffic, three-wheeled tuk-tuks, and donkey carts. The move comes weeks after the government announced a project to build a new capital southeast of Cairo. That's a look at business news. Far From the Maddening Crowd was a novel by Thomas Hardy, and like many well-known literary works, it has now been adopted as a movie, which drew in an Oscar-nominated actress to its cast, and also the interest of David Byrd on today's edition of Now. But first, we need to tidy up the American Cafe a bit, as Ira Melman tells us about a huge swirl of garbage that is floating in the North Pacific Ocean and how researchers are trying to track it.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. A huge garbage patch in the North Pacific Ocean traps debris from both hemispheres and is a major environmental threat to sea life. Michael Sullivan joins us from Honolulu, where researchers are tracking the trash that covers a huge swath of the Pacific.
The culprit is plastic, which finds its way into waterways and eventually the ocean. Scientists at the University of Hawaii head to sea in research vessels to monitor the effects of the trash on marine life. The trash concentrates in five of the Earth's ocean gyres, which are naturally occurring circular currents, says marine scientist Dave Carl.
As you get closer and closer to the center of that, the central axis of that feature, the waters become more quiescent. So they tend to trap floating debris.
The Pacific trash patch is famously as big as the U.S. state of Texas, but Carl says what is seen from passing ships is mostly empty ocean.
The impression that people, I think, got about this patch was that it was a solid mass of plastic. You could almost jump off your boat and walk across the state of Texas on this plastic footing. That's not the way it is at all.
He says the churning of the ocean quickly reduces much of the plastic to a chemical sludge. Alan Clark of Hawaii's East-West Center says it is dangerous in that form, since tiny plankton organisms consume the particles.
That are eaten by things like jellyfish, who turn out to be one of the favorite food of larger fish. And then you go through the food chain to tuna and things of this nature.
And the cycle is completed as people find the plastics on their beaches and chemicals in contaminated food. These scientists are tracking the impact of pollution in the North Pacific, but they say pollution is a problem in all of the Earth's oceans. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Honolulu.
The U.S. Capitol Dome in Washington, D.C. is recognized worldwide as one of the most enduring symbols of the U.S. government and American democracy. Now, since last November, the dome has been wrapped in metal scaffolding and fabric, all part of a long overdue renovation project. VOA's Jeff Custer is in the cafe with more on that.
The last time the U.S. Capitol Dome underwent a renovation was in 1960. Since then, the dome has become weathered and worn, and as the architect of the Capitol reports, has more than 1,000 cracks and other defects. The dome was first completed around 1863. Its cast iron frame, says U.S. Senate historian Don Ritchie, has contributed to that weathering.
The Capitol dome being cast iron has been hit by lightning countless times, and it's been weathering that position since 150 years, since 1863. And it has been leaking lately. And there's a lot of artwork inside, including the big canopy in the center. And so the current construction is to repair the leaks, to fill the cracks, to take off excess layers of paint, and to paint it again.
As the work to remove old paint and apply primer continues, a large section of the building is covered by plastic and a special pink fabric designed to reduce wind and protect workers from the elements. Much of the construction is done after dark to prevent the noise from disturbing lawmakers who continue to meet inside. Some visitors to the Capitol, hoping for a souvenir picture of the usually gleaming dome, have been let down by the current view.
It was dramatic. It's very fantastic. It's all white. But when I come here today, it's under construction, so my family can't see it clearly.
The project is expected to take more than 2 years to totally complete. It is scheduled to be ready for the inauguration of a new president in February of 2017. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. It's available every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Brit Lit comes to the big screen with a new adaptation of Thomas Hardy's novel, Far From the Madding Crowd. This version has Oscar-nominated actress Carey Mulligan playing Bathsheba Everdeen, a fiercely independent woman in Victorian England who has just inherited her uncle's farm. That inheritance gives Bathsheba financial independence and sets up the drama of her pursuit by three very different suitors: Gabriel Oak, a sheep farmer, Frank Troy, a handsome and personally irresponsible army sergeant, and William Boldwood, her prosperous and mature bachelor neighbor. Mulligan says that she usually steers clear of period dramas in order to avoid being typecast. But the 29-year-old actress said when she read the book and realized she had the chance to work with Danish-born director Thomas Vinterberg, she jumped at it.
I had no real clue of the story. I had an idea of there being a lead character called Bathsheba, but other than that, I didn't know. And when I read the book, I just completely fell in love with the story and with the character. And then also with the idea of working with Thomas Vinterberg, because I was such a fan of his previous films. You know, I discovered this incredibly modern woman, and the fact that this story starts with a girl in Victorian Britain turning down a proposal of marriage as opposed to actively going out to seek it just seemed like such a great way to start a story.
Bathsheba, who in the novel is known as much for her vanity as for her fierce independence, decides to play a trick one Valentine's Day on William Boldwood. She sends him a valentine that reads, "Marry me," but she does not sign it. Eventually, Boldwood becomes obsessed with capturing and marrying Bathsheba. Michael Sheen plays Boldwood and says he was fascinated by the character's descent from being in total control of his life to losing himself to his obsession.
He's a man at the beginning of the story who is described as being so dignified and so controlled and so remote in so many ways. And yet he's someone who you see lose a lot of his dignity, and certainly he's not withdrawn anymore. And so the idea of this kind of this person who has protected himself and built up a kind of force field around himself, and slowly that starts to unravel, and seeing a man who is aware that that is happening to him as well and yet can't do anything about it, I thought was very interesting.
Matthias Schoenaerts plays Gabriel Oak, the sheep herder who goes to work for Bathsheba, gets fired by her, but eventually gets back into her good graces by saving her sheep herd. When Bathsheba marries Sergeant Troy, Gabriel goes to work for Boldwood, eventually managing the farm for the wealthy bachelor. Schoenaerts says the challenge for him as an actor was to portray Gabriel Oak not as good or evil, but as someone who feels deeply and really loves Bathsheba Everdeen.
But what I thought was the most important is to, you know, and his name says it, he's an oak, he's strong. And why is he so strong? It's because he sees things in a bigger perspective, and he's patient. And so he's a rock, and he doesn't allow himself to, you know, to get lost in frustrating anecdotes and circumstantial frustrations and stuff. So he's always above that.
The film also includes a scene in which Bathsheba and William Boldwood sing a duet after dinner one night. Carey Mulligan says she was a little nervous doing the scene, but in the end she was able to pull it off.
I think I was always comforted by the idea that she wasn't meant to be a great singer. And so, yeah, we sang. And I love that scene says so much about, she's the first time she has any real connection with Boldwood, and Oak is there to see it, and it's sort of awkward and heartbreaking. And
Far from the madding crowd also stars June Temple as Fanny Robin, a servant girl who has a dark past with Sergeant Troy. The film is rated PG-13 for some sexuality and violence. So, are you a fan of this kind of film? If so, do you have a favorite one? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments about anything you hear on our show to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
All right, kids, don't try this at home, but home is where a 73-year-old California man punched a 300-pound bear. The bear appeared to be attacking his dog, and he said he'd do it again to protect his beloved pets. Carl Moore is from Meadow Vista. He heard his Chihuahua Lacey whimpering in fear as the bear tried to get up on the deck. Moore said he decided to show that bear he wasn't afraid. He ran straight toward it with his arms raised. The bear retreated, turned and faced him, and boom, I hit him, said Moore. It's time for sports on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. Well, the fight of the century, do you agree with that? Regardless of whether you do or you don't, Floyd Mayweather Jr. was the champion and cemented his place in boxing history by improving to an undefeated 48-0 with a unanimous decision over Manny Pacquiao Saturday night in Las Vegas in a fight that some say lived up to its immense hype and price tag. Others online I saw thought it was a little bit boring. Either way, Mayweather weathered an early assault from the Filipino southpaw before winning the later rounds using his reach and jab to finish ahead on all three scorecards in the welterweight showdown, set to be the top-grossing prize fight of all time. Mayweather in the ring said when the history books are written, it was worth the wait. Well, they did at least unify four belts, and it was more than 5 years in the making for this bout, although Pacquiao repeatedly forced Mayweather to backpedal. The wily American blunted his opponent's best efforts by using his renowned defensive skills while getting in several telling jabs and punches of his own. Roger Federer is also a winner on the tennis courts. He took the inaugural Istanbul Open Sunday by beating third seed Pablo Cuevas 6-3, 7-6 for his first clay title in 3 years. The world number two took his 85th ATP world title to end a long drought on clay dating back to 2012. That at the Madrid Masters, which was played on a slick blue surface. It's been a while since I won a title on clay, said the jubilant Swiss after receiving a hero's welcome all week in Istanbul. It's been a pleasure playing here, he said. Well, I guess so. If you win, Federer now has won titles in 19 different countries. Not even Usain Bolt could overcome a big American lead as the U.S. men sprinted to a convincing victory over Jamaica in the 4x100 meters relay at the IAAF World Relays in Nassau on Saturday. Mike Rogers, Justin Gatlin, and Tyson Gay powered the Americans to a 5-meter advantage through three legs of the highly anticipated race. Ryan Bailey brought the team home in 37.38 seconds. Bolt missed last year's inaugural World Relays. He made up some ground but could not quite close the gap as Jamaica placed second. That's sports.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Back during the fall and then winter of 2013-2014, University of Washington climate scientist Nick Bond noticed a big and nearly circular patch of Pacific Ocean water just off the West Coast that didn't cool off as much as it normally did. Since this warmer-than-usual patch of water didn't have a name, Bond began to call it the Blob. Bond thinks that the blob may have played a part of Washington State's mild 2014 winter and could indicate a warmer-than-usual summer. Scientists from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, along with Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans, joined Bond to learn more about the blob. Nick Bond joins us to talk about the blob and its influence on weather and marine life along the West Coast.
The blob itself, and what I really got fascinated in, was this circular patch of warm water that developed off the coast of the Pacific Northwest in the winter of 2013-2014. And I got so interested in it because the water was so much warmer than normal, and it was in a place that we usually don't see temperature anomalies of that magnitude.
Do you have any possible causes for the formation of this phenomenon? Does climate change have anything to do with it?
No, it doesn't look like it's climate change per se. It was a weird weather pattern, unusually light winds and from a different direction than usual. And how it formed was that mostly it was because less heat was being drawn up from the ocean into the atmosphere, and to a certain extent also kind of warmer water was moving into the region from the south. So it was kind of part of the same weird weather patterns that caused drought in California, some cold weather in the eastern U.S. was responsible for the blob.
Let me reverse it. So is the blob doing any controlling of the weather, such as you mentioned, the drought and perhaps the extreme cold in eastern United States?
No, the blob on the large scale is mostly a result rather than a cause of the weather. It does have some secondary effects on temperatures right along the Pacific coast, especially western Washington, western Oregon, that sort of thing. The prevailing winds are from the west, and so since that air has been going over warmer water, it's been kind of warmed and humidified to a certain extent. But we basically have to blame the atmosphere for making the blob rather than the reverse.
What about other impacts on the environment, such as wildlife and marine life?
Oh, yeah, there's big impacts there, and that is something that's kind of abiding interest and going to be a future work also. It turns out that a lot of the species along the west coast of North America do better when the water is cold, and when the water is warmer than normal, the kind of base of the food chain isn't as productive, and the organisms that are there aren't as nutritious. It's kind of like eating rice cakes rather than potato chips. And so there's repercussions all up the food chain.
Is this something similar to the weather phenomena we know as El Nino or La Nina?
This relates to the kind of the formation of the weird weather that caused the blob. And there it's something that's sort of akin to El Nino and La Nina, but kind of a different sort of thing. And in particular, a colleague of mine, Dennis Hartman, has shown that what was going on in the far western tropical Pacific around New Guinea, warm waters there and large masses of thunderstorms had this ripple effect downstream, kind of like El Nino has a ripple effect over much of the globe. And so at least to a large extent, we can attribute the weird weather to what was going on in the far western tropical Pacific.
You mentioned that this was found in the winter of 2013. How did you discover it?
I'm the climatologist for the state of Washington, and we were having weird weather along the west, and I was kind of going, wow, this is really something. And then a lot of my research has to do with air-sea interactions, and I couldn't help but notice that the water was just much warmer in this spot off the Pacific Northwest than we'd have really ever seen before for that time of year. And so that kind of got my interest going in it and in kind of looking at just what mechanisms were responsible for it.
That was University of Washington climate scientist and Washington State climatologist Nick Bond. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo.
The swimming pool at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, is typically used by students to swim laps and members of the dive team and some instructors, but all that activity has now come to a halt because thousands of Mexican free-tailed bats have decided they want to live there. The flying mammals suddenly moved in because they were booted from their primary home at Kyle Field, the football stadium, which is now undergoing renovations. The furry flyers used to live there year-round, but the noise and disruption has forced them now to seek shelter elsewhere. And the bats are going all over the place on the college campus, but they seem to like the swimming pool the best. According to experts, most bats fly high enough so they rarely come into contact with humans. Also, contrary to popular belief, very few of them carry rabies.
And as many Bats live in eastern Texas for years, stadium officials didn't see much reason to oust them from their main home at Kyle Field, where there's even a large sign there declaring the premises a Bat-friendly stadium. Eventually, though, the Bats had to became rather tough to coexist with. Of course, Bats have droppings, and they made life somewhat unpleasant at the stadium and raised some health risks because food, of course, is served there during games. So 2 years ago, school officials started to take efforts to rid the facilities of the Bats. They might want to look a little bit to the east. The University of Florida of Gainesville had a similar problem. They built roof-like structures to help Bats live there. I don't see any Bats here in Studio 22, but it's still time for us to fly out. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Rawlings, and Zainab Abdel-Rahman, and our managing editor, who's very detailed-oriented, Diane Gal. I'm Jim Stevenson. Join us back here again tomorrow.